Now, tonight, I'd like to thank Steve for making the connection with Howard Resnick, who I am so, if you saw his, the flyer that I sent out, I am just in awe of his accomplishments.
Yes.
In addition to everything else, we had a little conversation earlier this evening in Portuguese. Not me, others who were here. And Howard is an expert and is a true scholar of Indian philosophy, Vedanta, and Sanskrit, has translated, please, tell me if I'm saying
correct,
has translated Indian texts from the original Sanskrit. And he is a practitioner of bhakti yoga for many, many decades and has lectured all over the world and has started spiritual communities all over the world. He's lectured at Harvard, Yale, Cambridge, Oxford. And I'm so happy to have him here at the Joseph Campbell Roundtable. Thank you. Howard.
Thank you very much for coming. I thought I would begin by, well, of course, first thanking Joyce for kindly having me here. And, of course, thanking you all for coming. I'm speaking tonight consciously as a beneficiary of the work of Joseph Campbell. And so I wanted to first express my own gratitude to him for the work he did. He was born in 1904, as many of you know. And so he lived a full three quarters of his life, mostly in America with some trips abroad. But he lived a full three quarters of his life in a country which did not celebrate diversity. It was, by many people, seen as something for which you sort of call the exterminators. So he grew up in a very different culture. He was, and of course he responded to that. So we know he's a pioneer. We know that he was the person who, in the most dramatic and perhaps the most intelligent way, kind of forced intelligent people to see, simply by the power of his presentation, forced intelligent people to see that there is a unity between among all the different religious and spiritual traditions. They tell many of the same stories, they have many of the same ideas, and that somehow or other they're not merely different. In the Bhagavad Gita, by the way, which is perhaps the single most important book from India in the ancient yoga, Sanskrit, Vedic / Hindu tradition, in the Bhagavad Gita, the cell phone announcement.
I was turning mine off.
Unless you have like a really great danceable ringtone, then you can leave it on. So in the Bhagavad Gita, chapter 18, text 20, the good book. In the Bhagavad Gita, Krishna described those people who see beyond the diversity of the world. They're, you know, different species and different races and different kinds of people. We are, but behind all this diversity, this kaleidoscopic diversity, there is one unified existence. And Krishna describes people that see that way as being predominantly virtuous. If you know in the Bhagavad Gita, in fact, throughout the whole yoga teaching, because yoga as a word, I'm trying not to get too deviant here, yoga as a word is often contrasted with another Sanskrit word, Sankhya, which together means Sankhya Yoga, which means something like philosophy and practice. So if you know the Yoga Sutras of Patanjali, the ancient yoga teachings and wisdom sort of assumes as the foundational philosophy of the yoga system, the Sankhya teaching. So in that Sankhya teaching, which you find in Bhagavad Gita, you find it in the Yoga Sutras and elsewhere, there are three qualities of life: ignorance, passion, and goodness. Goodness meaning virtue, tranquility, wisdom, selflessness, compassion, and so on. Passion meaning selfishness. Instead of selflessness, grasping, ambition, pride, vanity, and all those highly desirable qualities. And then ignorance means just someone, you know, basically is out of it. either drugged or just grossly irrational and just ignorant in that sense. So these are called gunas. The Sanskrit word is guna because this is actually a key word in what I want to present for the following reason. But just returning to Joseph Campbell, I mean, we're going to talk about him. But so he was a pioneer. He did make all these breakthroughs. He did show intelligent, reasonable people that we have to be reasonable about world religions, not be fanatical, not be crazy about it, kill each other about it, and so on. And so because I have personally been studying and practicing something within the Eastern tradition, you could say, Bhakti Yoga for most of my life, I very much feel I'm a beneficiary of the pioneering work he did in making those options more easily available to all of us and more socially acceptable, and just creating a climate in which those things, let's say in the 60s, could actually be explored seriously. So I personally feel like a beneficiary of his good work. The reason this word guna is important is because the word literally in Sanskrit means quality. And it's used in two very different ways, which are often confused in Wikipedia articles. The word can be used, and this is kind of key because, okay, let me lay this out very briefly. What I want to try to show is that Joseph Campbell, and this is the opinion of various historians and scholars, because he was, I think, heroically struggling against this religious fanaticism and trying to get people to be reasonable about it, he felt that this religious fanaticism, which in America tend to be emanating from a particular religious community, which shall go unnamed, you know, a very widespread religion in this country. And so he saw, look, in all these different religions, people give different names to their deity. Like, for example, in India, the god of thunder is Indra. And in Greece, it was Zeus. And then you have Thor. Pretty good movie. But anyway, yeah. Then you have Thor and all these different figures and other names in other cultures. And so he said that... let me read you something that Joseph Campbell said, and then we'll get back to this guna, because I accept as valid, really, a tremendous amount of the work he did, as groundbreaking, as an invaluable contribution. And so what I want to focus on is that once he sort of cleared the atmosphere so you could talk about these things, he himself, from what he wrote and said, chose a specific solution to the problem of religious diversity and conflict. And if you study the history of religion, and specifically now, not necessarily just the history of rituals or the history of even mythology, but if you look at religion in the hands of the theologians, the philosophers, whether it's in Buddhism or the intellectual movements in Islam that began, let's say, well, maybe 1,000 or 1,100 years ago, very interesting, sophisticated movements, Maimonides in medieval Spain and the debates he had with other Jews who had other views. And if you look at the whole Vedanta tradition, I'll explain what the word Vedanta means very quickly. Guna, our little orphan here, is going to get some attention later. So yeah. The word Veda in Sanskrit means knowledge. It comes from an Indo-European root or Sanskrit root vid. It's the same word that we find for, which was often pronounced as W, the V. So it's the same word we have in the English word wit, intelligence, the German wissen, which means to know. Words like video or the Latin vedere, to see. And so on. So it's kind of like this ubiquitous Indo-European root, which means to know, to see. And in Sanskrit, Veda means knowledge, from the verb vid, to know. And so the word anta is also, yeah, because it's just the English word end. I mean, you can see that it's the same word. So the end of knowledge, or the culmination of knowledge, Vedanta. So in India, I explain this now to try to locate Joseph Campbell, so to speak, on the historical map of philosophizing about religion. In India, there were various philosophies. It was from the very beginning. Actually, if you go back thousands of years, India was a free society. They had freedom. For example, you read texts that are thousands of years old, like Mahabharata. People could go into the town square and just say the king's a jerk. And it wasn't like off with their heads. There was no reprisal. There's not even a hint. Like, that was totally out of the question. There's no punishment for that. It's just the king would think, whoops, better, you know, do some better PR here. So there was that kind of freedom of speech. Megasthenes, a Greek ambassador to India, claims in his book Indica, which means about India, he wrote about 2,300 years ago, India was the only country he knew that didn't have slavery. And because it has the best river system in the world, it's always had, compared to other places, a large population, a very good soil, moderate climate, plenty of natural irrigation, freedom. And so if you put all these things together, it was always a prosperous country when it wasn't a colony. So you find the full display of religiosity. Any almost conceivable way or inconceivable way to be religious or spiritual or mystical, someone did it in India and started a movement about it. So that Buddhism arose, for example, and this is unimaginable in Europe, where you had a religion, the Vedic religion, then about 2,500 years ago, there's certain dissatisfaction. Very short version, the Vedic religion had become an unresponsive monopoly. And therefore, there were sort of counter movements. People were unsatisfied with a rigid social system, social hierarchy. They thought it's become too ritualistic and materialistic, got to get back to the spiritual roots. So there are various movements rebelling against kind of like this unresponsive monopoly. Very similar to another rebellion that took place in Palestine, where the Essenes went to the Dead Sea because they were unhappy with Jerusalem and the temple culture and so on. And wrote the Dead Sea Scrolls as kind of like a protest spirituality and alternative spirituality to the mainstream stuff in Jerusalem. So in the same way, they went to the Dead Sea because, just, you know, if you want to get away from Jerusalem, that's kind of where you go. Whereas India had all kinds of forests, so sages went to the forest. So you get this Aranyaka literature, the forest books, which developed into the Upanishads, these mystic theological texts, the Upanishads. And the Vedanta, by the way, is the summary of the Upanishads. You have all these different Upanishads, and then the Vedanta comes along and kind of organizes them and explains what they all mean. So some people stayed within the Vedic fold and did their thing, the Aranyakas, Upanishads. But some people left. Some people said, we're out of here, bye-bye Vedic culture. And they formed new movements like, for example, Buddhism or Jainism. So this is all about 2,500 years ago, all this stuff was going on. And so you had this new movement, say, Buddhism or Jainism, which thousands of years ago was actually just as important as Buddhism, but then it, for various historical reasons, became brand X, and Buddhism became very big. But anyway, the point here is that Buddhism grew very strongly without any diplomacy or politeness, criticized the existing Vedic culture. And they didn't, no one fought a war about it. They just kind of debated. So you have this free culture and many different schools of thought. And I'll bring this back to the point here. This is not age related. I'm not just wandering. So anyway, I'm like psychotherapist here. So the idea is that when all these different movements and traditions and religions and philosophies, which were all competing freely, when it all kind of got sorted out, there were six teachings, six schools that were very powerful, had some following, and that eventually got boiled down to the big winner. The big winner, at least in Indian intellectual history, that kind of took the gold, you know, the gold medal home and really established itself as the predominant intellectual worldview in that region was Vedanta. And Joseph Campbell, who loved India and wanted to learn Sanskrit, was very much influenced by this Vedanta, because the reason I gave that whole little preface is because if you look at Vedanta in India, there's a great divide among the powerful, important commentators. People, to be technical here, when you say Vedanta, it may refer sometimes to what is called the Brahma Sutras, Sutra, like English word suture, it's an Indo-European word, is a sutra is a ridiculously pithy little statement. That it's so pithy, it's like, what the heck does that mean? So they need commentaries. So the Brahma Sutras are all these sort of uber pithy statements that were supposed to explain the Upanishads. So therefore, to understand what the heck the Vedanta Sutras, the Brahma Sutras meant, there are all these commentaries. That was like the major leagues of intellectual, philosophical, theological activity in India for 1,000 or 2,000 years. If you wanted to be taken seriously as a major thinker, you had to write a commentary in Vedanta. And if you look at the commentaries, they divide kind of neatly into two camps. And these two different groups, these two worldviews, also map very cleanly onto the great theological divide in other traditions, like medieval Judaism, like Islam, when they had in their glory days of theology about 1,000 years ago. And so this great divide between two powerful worldviews, which you find in Vedanta commentaries and elsewhere, is relevant tonight because Joseph Campbell came down very strongly on one side. And which is very interesting because, I think that's extremely obvious when you read what he said. And so what I want to do is talk about what his metaphysical worldview was. How he understood transcendence. There have been Christian criticisms of Joseph Campbell, though I have no reason why. But anyway, the Christians have criticized, and one of the things they've said is he's a materialist because, well, here's a quote from Joseph Campbell, which perhaps they've misunderstood. Let's see my cliff notes here. Yes, in his last book, The Inner Reaches of Outer Space, he says, the deity of one's worship, which is kind of a paraphrase of a Sanskrit term, Ishta Devata, which is sort of like the deity you've chosen to worship among many deities. So, the deity of one's worship is a function of one's own state of mind. But it is also a product of one's culture. So taking, let's say, spiritual or transcendent or divine or celestial claims and bringing them back, sort of, to use a philosophical term, reducing them in the sense that, like you reduce a fraction, you know, 4/8 is 1/2. So what's taking these things as metaphors, Campbell's been criticized, I think probably incorrectly, of being a materialist in the sense of dragging the gods down from heaven and just reinterpreting them as aspects of human psychology and social dynamics. But as I think more serious or perhaps more objective scholars have noticed, Campbell does have a sense of the transcendent, of the divine. It's just very interesting what he says about it, which we're going to talk about. So, so what is, and the reason I mentioned guna, I'll explain why that word is there. I've neglected it long enough. The word guna has two primary meanings. It can mean various things. If you look in a typical, like say, a Sanskrit dictionary for a word, it means everything from like goodness, a plant with a Latin name, or a hummingbird, or you know, a type of rice. And so, because Sanskrit has been used by intelligent people for thousands and thousands of years, and Indian culture tends to be cumulative. They sort of keep everything. They don't throw things away. So they've got like innumerable linguistic tchotchkes, you could say. But the main two meanings of the word guna, which are relevant to our discussion, and the way the word's used philosophically, it can mean in Sankhya philosophy, as I explained, the philosophy behind the yoga system, these qualities of goodness, passion, and ignorance. So that, for example, one of the main terms Krishna uses in the Bhagavad Gita to say transcend or transcendent, which is a word Joseph Campbell used, is... I'll break up guna, and then ati, which means beyond, and then ita, literally gone beyond the gunas. So spiritual existence is literally defined as being beyond these material qualities. Your consciousness has transcended all material qualities, and your consciousness now is functioning on a pure spiritual level. Now, because of this use of the word guna, by the way, the E, I just can't resist. If you know Spanish, the verb ir, to go, right? And the R is just the infinitive marker. It's actually E. It's the same as the Sanskrit verb. But anyway, back to our regular evening program. So guna ati ita literally means one who has gone beyond the gunas. And so, another thing Joseph Campbell mentions, because he was very interested in Indian philosophy, is that if you know Vedanta, or if you ever read a book on Hinduism, you'll always come across this, that there are two main conceptions of God. One is saguna. Sa means with qualities, and one is nirguna, which means without qualities. Nir means without. This, by the way, historically was a philosophical problem for Buddhism, because the ultimate perfection was grammatically a negative word. Nir means without. And so this, nirvana means nirvana. And vana means the current of material existence, birth and death, and just, you know, always getting it wrong because you're not a Buddhist. And so nirguna and saguna, without guna and with guna. Now, the problem, and again, which leads to all kinds of Wikipedia mistakes, is that the word guna also can mean simply a quality in general. Not a material quality, but just a quality. For example, a very common set of antonyms in Sanskrit literature is guna and dosha. If you know, if you've ever been in an Indian restaurant, it's not that dosha. So, dosha means a bad quality, a flaw, a fault, something wrong with something. That's called dosha. And so, guna means good quality, something which is just the way it should be. So, we can talk about God having guna qualities, like, for example, beauty. God is beautiful. Or God is loving. Or God is clever or funny or the life of the party or whatever. So we can talk about those things and we can use the word guna, but we're not talking about the material qualities. And that's something which is often not understood. So the word nirguna does not rule out God having some type of personal qualities. Anyway, so what I'd like to do is... any questions so far on this? Yes.
It's not really a question, it's a comment. You mentioned something about India not having slaves. But, you know, with the caste system and the untouchables, I mean, you had a system that basically had slave labor or cheap labor.
Yeah, that's a little anachronistic because...
into the time frame.
Right, yeah. Definitely, I mean, India definitely has gone through serious social problems in that regard. We should remember, though, that practically every country in the world, or even, I say region, because even country is a little anachronistic because, you know, the formation of nation states is kind of related. But practically every civilization in the world had a hereditary caste system. The only reason it ended in Europe was because of the Industrial Revolution. So Europe very much had their hereditary caste system. And... It's as far as the fate or the treatment, let's say, of the lower classes in India at that time. I think in every society which has hierarchy, and every pre-industrial society does, in America, is, of course, we live in a wonderful plutocracy now. You know, the former democracy. And so, but, I mean, look how, I mean, if you... We could go on, we could literally depress ourselves almost to the point of becoming suicidal if we talk about the way people are being exploited in this country. So. Okay, yeah.
Why don't we get back to the...
Sure.
Speech.
Yeah, but anyway.
Thank you.
So, yes.
You mentioned in responding to the Christian criticism of Campbell as materialistic, you said that you think he does understand the transcendent...
I think he has the notion of transcendence, which I'm going to talk about next. I personally am not completely comfortable with his notion of transcendence, but he does talk about it.
Well, the question is, in that regard, he talks about not that intellectual understanding, but actual experience and rapture.
Right.
Or the rapture of an experience of transcendence. And he says, in terms of Christianity, sometimes the last image, the last obstacle in the way of experiencing that rapture is the image of Jesus. As a Catholic himself, like, what do you think he meant like that? I've been trying to figure that out.
Okay, I'm going to talk right about that point. So thank you. That was a great introduction to what I'm about to do. So, but we're going to touch upon that very directly now, okay?
Okay.
So, yeah, he's a plant. So I am going to make a critique of some of Joseph Campbell's statements. I would say, as someone who's grateful to him, who admires his work, and even I think with some affection, because I do like Joseph Campbell, but I think actually, let me quote from Joseph Campbell why I think he would enjoy us doing this, or me doing it. I don't want to, you know, make you a partner in crime. Joseph Campbell said, "There are no horizons. There are no horizons. That is the mean of the space age. We are in free fall into a future that is mysterious. Very fluid, and this is disconcerting to many people." In other words, Campbell embraced and welcomed the fact that everything's opening up and we can talk freely. And so I want to build on what he did and keep the conversation going, which is, I think, what he wanted to happen. So here's I'm going to give some quotes from Campbell and try to lay out some of his position on certain key issues, and then show why it falls very clearly into one of these two opposing schools, not only in Vedanta, but actually in the history of theology and metaphysics. So, for example, Campbell says, well, he says a lot of things, but the transcendent is unknowable and unknown. God is transcendent. Finally, if anything like the name God, God is beyond names and forms. The mystery of life is beyond all human conception. Eternity is beyond all categories of thought. God is, when he says God, he means that name God, that word God. God is a thought. God is a name, an idea. But it refers to something that transcends all thinking. In other words, it's language pointing beyond itself. The ultimate mystery of being is beyond all categories of thought. So, I don't want to be obnoxious. I mean, as far as I can avoid it. But, you know, the obvious... Marlene, my old fender, she's going to tell me if I'm getting, like, out of control here. So, she's going to make a sign that stop. I mean, the first point, I don't just mean to play games with words. This is not a word game. I think it's a serious philosophical point. If God is absolutely unknowable, then you wouldn't know that God is unknowable. I mean, because to say God is unknowable is to know something about God, namely that God is unknowable. And that's also a concept. And so the idea is that, well, we're using words because we have to, because we've got nothing else to sort of point at something, but it's not. But this gets into the philosophy of language. Because what Campbell is saying here, and this is right out of the impersonal Vedanta playbook, which Joseph Campbell obviously knew very well. I mean, he was a very distinguished scholar. He loved India, and he knew about this Vedanta. He studied it. And so what he's saying is not original. A lot of his work is original, but this is just right out of the impersonal Vedanta. The idea that, take language, for example, that somehow there's a radical divide, there's a radical cutoff where now we experience ourselves as persons. Every one of us is the seat of an individual personal consciousness. As William James said, we have no experience of consciousness which doesn't belong to somebody. So every one of us is a personal, conscious, unique individual. We have volition, we will, we have personal will, we think, we have emotions, and so on. We reason. So, and we use language. Language is central to our existence. If I said to you, for example, think about life without language, well, you can't think without language because you'd have to think conceptually. So language is at the very core of what it means to be a conscious, reasoning creature. And so to say that words fail to reach God, this is called ineffability, which is all around the world you find mystics and people that make this claim. is to say that something, perhaps the essence of our personal existence, at some level, is false. It's not real. When you get to the highest reality, you're not really a person. You don't use language. You don't have concepts. And perhaps to make this more clear, let me lay out the other worldview. The other worldview, which is found, for example, in Bhagavad Gita, it's the worldview of Plato. It's certainly the worldview of the Neoplatonists. And it's the worldview of many world religions. And that is that things like language, music, love, just communication, all these things are not ultimately mundane. These are not ultimately or originally profane, mundane, helplessly material. Rather, it's the opposite. All these things are originally infinite. They're originally infinite. A personal consciousness is originally infinite. Language is originally infinite. Beauty is originally infinite. Music, pleasure, everything is originally infinite. And it becomes reflected in this world. For example, let's say you're standing at the side of a clear pond, which is, has a mirror-like surface. And you see an apple tree in the pond. And let's say you don't know it's a reflection. You think that's a real apple tree. And you're hungry. So you go to grab an apple, and you realize, wait a second, that's an illusion. That's an illusion. But if someone says, well, wait a second, that's an illusion, but there's a real apple tree, look there, and you'll see an actual apple tree with apples you can eat. And so, this is the essence of Plato, if you know your Plato, that the things of this world, all the things of this world, are mere reflections, are mere shadows. Think of the myth of the cave. People chained in a cave merely seeing shadows of reality. But when they go out of the cave, Plato doesn't conclude that ultimately there are no real forms. There are no real names for things. He says when you get out of the cave, then you see the real objects, of which you were merely seeing shadows. Krishna, for example, in Bhagavad Gita, chapter 15, says that Urdhva Mula Madhak Shaka, the Sanskrit, so you see what it sounds like, it's a real language. Urdhva Mula Madhak Shaka Ashvatam Prahur Abhyayam. They say, it's a typical thing they say in Sanskrit, Prahur or Ahur, they say. In other words, people that know what they're talking about. So they say that there is a banyan tree. And if you know what a banyan tree is. There is a banyan tree whose roots go upward and branches go down. And so it's understood this is a reference to the reflected tree. So if you look at Plotinus, so the idea that this world is merely a reflection, a shadow of a real infinite world, which is personal, which is full of infinite colors and sounds and music and loving relationships. And So when we... here's an example from art, because Joseph Campbell liked Picasso, and I'm sure other artists. Let's say, for example, you are an art historian, and you study all the different ways in Europe and elsewhere that people have painted trees. You look at all the different ways that people have painted trees, all the different styles, which are probably unlimited. Now, they're all different. There's no question but that. Let's go back to Campbell's statement that the deity of one's worship is a function of two things. One's own state of mind, psychology, and is a product of one's culture, sociology. And he uses the term, product of psychology and sociology. But instead of talking about deities, let's talk about trees. People paint trees, and the way an artist paints a tree is because of the way that artist sees the world, their own psychology, and because, there are social influences. Artists are not immune to the fact that if I paint it this way, everybody will love me and buy my painting. If I paint that, not everyone wants to be unknown and starving. So, and even people who somehow do buy into kind of like the, that it's sexy to be an unknown, starving, great artist, but they want to be respected by other unknown, starving, great artists. So, because they have their own communities. So what I mean to say is no one is entirely immune from social dynamics. No man or woman is an island. All of us are affected in some way by other conscious beings. We have relationships. And so you can look at the trees, all the different paintings of trees, and say, if you conclude there is no real tree, what if there were art wars? What if actually history showed that people fought these, you know, really ghastly wars over art styles, and therefore someone came along and said the way to stop the art wars is to realize that you're all arguing over how to paint a tree. There is no tree. So that when you paint a tree in a certain way, it's just a product of your psychology and social influences upon you. The real fact is there are trees out in the world. And so even though every artist projects something of themselves onto the tree and something of society, there's still a family resemblance. They're all trees. Now, the first person that used the argument of projection that I know in Western philosophy is our good friend Xenophanes. Xenophanes was a pre-Socratic philosopher. Socrates is the watershed philosopher, so everybody's like pre-Socratic or post-Socratic. So Xenophanes said, and I think he thought that he was being just like unbelievably clever by saying this, but Xenophanes said that if you look at Greek gods, like statues and paintings, guess what? They look like Greeks. And if you look at Egyptian gods, they look like Egyptians. And Thracian gods, and you know, he went down the ethnology list. So if you look at all these different gods, they look like the people that worship them. And this is what Joseph Campbell says, by the way. He says exactly the same thing. And therefore, Xenophanes concludes, if horses and lions and oxen and so on had hands and could draw pictures, we'd get gods looking like lions and horses and oxen. So, okay, there's a few things to say to Xenophanes. Number one, I think it's significant that lions and horses and oxen don't have hands and don't paint pictures of gods, although apparently elephants do. But anyway, he chose the wrong animals. So, and secondly, again, the fact that, I mean, you've all seen those little brochures of the sort of like the super ripped Scandinavian Jesus. That's, you know, like this Adonis, this... And so, I mean, if you look at pictures of Jesus in different cultures, Jesus is African, he's Scandinavian, sort of everything but Palestinian. But what I mean to say is the fact that we project something of ourselves onto a tree or a deity or anything else doesn't mean we absolutely create that object. And so another point I wanted to make is that iconoclasm, and this Joseph Campbell uses the word, he says something like, I'll find it, I'm going to hunt this down, because it's really a good quote. Oh my God, I underlined it and everything. The first step... Oh, yes, I found it. Encino's Got Talent. So, the first step to mystical realization, that means if you don't do this, you're not even in the ball game. You like took the wrong turn and didn't even show up for the game. The first step to mystical realization is leaving such a defined God. In other words, God looks like this, like that, it's Zeus, it's Vishnu, it's, you know, you name it. A defined God where you can say something about God. You can say something about God. A defined God. The first step.
Defined with a D?
Defined. The first step to mystical realization is the leaving of such a defined God for an experience of transcendence. So... What? Yeah. So Joseph Campbell, when he says transcendence, he means you transcend all these features of personal conscious life, such as language, conceptualizing, defining, so on. All that gets left behind. So you wouldn't have a flute playing God like Krishna. So The first step is that you leave all this, you disengage the ethnic form of the elementary idea. In other words, there are various ethnicities in the world, and all these gods were just kind of like concocted or created by different ethnic traditions.
Well, it's creating God in our own image is what it is.
Yes. Again, but again, yeah, exactly, like the artist that paints a tree based on, but we wouldn't say there are no real trees. So he said, for any God who is not transparent to transcendence, which is a little tricky what he means there, but obviously he means no ethnic stuff, no definition and so on. Transparent, just like. Then, otherwise it's an idol. Its worship is idolatry. Now, I would like to give another way of looking at iconoclasm. There's another way to look at this. I would like to make the argument that the very heavy iconoclasm of the Old Testament, which carried through to the New Testament, and by the way, it carried in the Old Testament just because a certain party won. If you read the Old Testament carefully, there were like tons of people in Israel that thought we should worship deities like in India or other parts of the world. They just didn't win. But they were there. And in fact, this is very interesting. If you study in the New Old Testament the history of the first temple in Jerusalem, built by Solomon, you find that practically most of the time that temple existed, they had little deities in the temple. Most of the time. In fact, Solomon himself, who built the temple, had a, I guess what Jewish people would say, a shiksa wife. He had one non-Jewish wife. And he built her a shrine for her pagan deities on the temple grounds. That's in the Old Testament. But a certain group won, and the winners tell the history. But in any case, this certainly carried through to the New Testament, I mean to Christianity, although it creeped back in because there was a time when there were all kinds of deities and things in Catholic churches, and if you study the history of the Reformation period, there was, for example, in Holland of all places, you know, which is supposed to be like, you know, very tolerant and all that, but they had what historians call iconoclastic furies, where basically violent gangs of Protestants would go to Catholic churches and smash everything that had an image on it, such as a stained glass window or a statue of, you know, Jesus, Mary, or any other relevant person. So, and they call these iconoclastic furies. And then Islam, for example, the greatest offense in Islam is called shirk in Arabic, which means to somehow give some material attribute to God. So that in the Wahhabi revolution about 200 years ago, we got the current form of Islam where they so much believe, for example, they couldn't even paint pictures, no religious art. That's why if you look at Islamic culture, they became so good at calligraphy, like really, because they weren't allowed to even paint religious art. And you had, of course, great artists. They had nothing else to do, but let's do really fancy alphabets because there's nothing else they could do. So there's this very powerful iconoclastic, it's not even a strain, it's like a wave in the Abrahamic religions. And I would like to give another way of looking at it because we are, you know, most of us come from the West, and there's a very different way of looking at it that gives you a very different picture of reality. And I think if we want to work our way back to what paganism really was, not hearing about pagans from the people that persecuted and exterminated them, what was the Indo-European civilization? What's going on in India? I mean, what are they really thinking? Like, what are they thinking? Here's a way to look at it. I will even try, and really, go out on a rope here. This is my tightrope act. I will even try to show you that iconoclasm, this violent reaction against visible images, is related to the environmental problems we have today.
Interesting. Yeah, I get it.
Not. That have to do with architecture.
I want to ask something about, you know, about Islam and trying to portray, you know, your God, or that's Jewish as well. And I think it has to do with the fact that you're trying to take the infinite and put it into some, or contain it in something visual or material.
Okay.
In the Jewish religion, what little I know of my own religion,
right,
is that, you know, you don't portray God either.
Right. Now, in the Quran, by the way, and in the Old Testament, God is often spoken of as a judge, as a king, as a father, and so on and so forth. And so, you know, in any case, I'll get to the ontological point. I'll get right to the heart of the matter. From a philosophical point of view, it gets down to a simple question: what is matter? Because as you said, as you correctly said, it's maybe trying to put the infinite in the finite, but it was actually even more serious. It was juxtaposing, bringing into intimate contact that which is infinitely holy and sacred and that which is infinitely profane.
Which is an illusion.
Yes.
Because matter has been found to be an illusion.
Well, because if you say, for example, that it is offensive or illusory, or, Joseph Campbell speaks very pejoratively about it, all these things, to give a name to God or to give a form or even to create like a visit out of brass or ceramic or carving out of wood or all the different ways that people have made deities.
Or even chocolate.
Chocolate, right. So, yeah, so, but the real issue is...
Good
book. So, but the real question is, what is matter? What is matter? And the argument I want to give is this. If you look at the Middle East, with all due respect, it never developed an original systematic philosophical tradition. If you look at the great philosophical traditions of the world, they actually come from the Indo-European civilization. They came from South Asia, including Buddhist philosophy, Vedanta, and all that stuff, and Europe. Even if you look at China, the Middle East, they certainly had wisdom. They certainly had wisdom. But in terms of systematic metaphysics, systematic philosophy, that did not develop originally in the Middle East. Christianity became theological, and you could say perhaps philosophical, in Europe. It's when Christianity went to Europe and encountered the Greco-Roman civilization. You see it in the first book of in the book of John. Because at the time, this is another point I wanted to bring up, at the time that the early Christians were trying to establish themselves in that civilization, there was a very popular idea among Stoics and other groups that God, a personal God, has divine reason. And he creates the world, he or she or they or it or whatever, creates the world with divine reason. That's why there's so many ologies like biology, the logic of life. And bios, life in Greek, or physio, this ology, that ology, because the creation is imbued, invested, permeated by this divine reason from the mind of God. And we also have that same divine reason within ourselves as creatures. And therefore, with our own reason, we can connect to the mind of God. And the word they use to express the reason which is in the mind of God, invested in the creation, exists within our minds, and through it we can connect to the mind of God, the word they used was logos. Logos. And it was an early, very early, maybe like second, third generation Christian attempt to connect to educated people in the Greco-Roman world for that reason that the book of John begins, "In the beginning was the logos," which we translate as word, but that's what it is in Greek. In the beginning was the logos. That was a transparent attempt to connect with educated people. And the logos became flesh. So actually Jesus incarnates the logos that you're talking about. So what I mean to say, even that attempt at being philosophical, even if you look at the traveling of Paul, if you look at his teachings in Athens, he kind of got really inspired, like, whoa, I'm in Athens. Because Athens was like, it was kind of like Harvard, Oxford, everything rolled into one. And so he actually preaches differently, tries to be philosophical because I'm in Athens. But what I mean to say is that because you have these Middle Eastern traditions not coming out of a systematic philosophical tradition, they're not really asking serious questions like, what is matter philosophically? You find certainly Parmenides asking that question, 100 years before Socrates. Like, what is the nature of matter? People are asking philosophically, what is matter? And so if you conclude, as Plotinus did, as the great Jewish philosopher Philo of Alexandria did around the time of Jesus, if you conclude that actually there's an ultimate oneness to existence, there may be diversity in that oneness. For example, there may be such a thing as matter, There may be such a thing as spirit. There may be such a thing as God. But somehow it's all one. It's all existence. It's all unified. And therefore, there is ultimately nothing profane. We may choose to do stupid things with matter, like oppress other people, or oppress our own bodies, or things like that. But the energy itself is not profane. And ultimately, it's not different from its own source. So you don't have a Middle Eastern creation ex nihilo, from nothing, where matter is like radically separated from God. Instead, you have an emanation theory, like in Plotinus or Philo, or like in Vedanta, where actually matter is simply an emanation streaming from the infinite existence of God. Comparable in Plato and in the Vedic tradition to the sun and the sun rays. So if you ask the simple question, the sun globe, and the sun rays, are they one? Or are they different? Is it just the sun shining? Or are there two things, globe and rays? And the answer is, the answer Philo, the great Jewish philosopher, gave, the answer Plotinus gave, and the answer the great Vedanta scholars like Ramanuja gave, is that both. It's one and different. So that you really are an individual person. That's real. You really are an individual person, and yet you're one with every other conscious being. You're simultaneously one and different, like the sun and its sun rays. So if we go back to matter, and we realize, according to this worldview, that there is a real oneness between the source and everything coming from the source, then the source appearing in its own emanation doesn't freak people out. And it was actually this radically negative view of matter. And by matter, I don't just mean like the stuff, but things that kind of come up in this world, like language. Language, which is sound, which is energy. But somehow language, no good. If you want to transcend, trash language, trash music, trash, you know, all this stuff. It all goes out the window. Your ability to reason, to conceptualize, everything goes. You have an experience where none of this stuff makes it. None of it makes the cut. It's all irredeemably, incorrigibly profane. And so really what's behind this whole iconoclastic idea, to be honest, is sort of the trashing of the material world. And therefore I said the environmental problems. And so if you see that, I think I've explained myself. So it's not just that some people that like weren't that smart, but, oh, here's a little cute God, I think I'll buy. You know, like Paul, when he traveled around the Mediterranean, they had little shops that sold little icons and things like that. Paul, by the way, gives an invalid argument in the New Testament. He says, how could these little icons be real deities? Because what people did, just like they still do in India, if you look at Greco-Roman religion, pagan religion, basically it's Mediterranean Hinduism. I mean, that's the short way to talk about it. So Paul gives the argument that if this is really a deity, why do you have to feed it? Why do you have to decorate it and things? If this is really a deity, it doesn't need you to feed it. My answer to Paul would be, hey, if you are serving the real God, he doesn't need you to speak on his behalf either. Because if God can cook his own food, he can also do his own talking. And so the real point is that, you know, God letting us do some service. Yes, please.
Just real quick, I feel kind of like you're setting up a straw man argument.
Sure, go ahead.
Because, some of the reasons, obviously I understand your connection of, you know, the destruction of the material. I think that's a little bit of a reach, because hopefully that's not a goal of anyone's, to destroy our environment or, you know, the planet or anything like that. But when you talk about the idea of creating deities, I think some of that is an intent to empower yourself over God. And I think that might be what people are reacting to. It's this idea that I can control this God. I can feed it and make it give me rain. I can, do something with it. I can have power over it. I can carry around the Ark of the Covenant and strike down my enemies. It's building things to contain God, you know, whatever it might happen to be, which I think is what people are reacting to. It's this idea that I'm using this as a substitute
for what
I should be looking for.
Okay.
Which is the infinite.
Okay. So let's assume for the purpose of discussion that you've made a valid argument.
Okay.
I mean, I'm not. I mean, I do. Yeah. Okay.
simplifying.
Yeah. I think, okay, I've laid out the basics, but I think I can defend it. And I think that your point is good. It's a very good point. And I think it will bring out more of what I'm saying. Because you can't say everything at once. So let me address your point. There's no question but that you're right, that people do misuse or try to misuse or abuse or exploit what they believe to be a relationship with the deity. And in, for example, the personal school of Vedanta, they criticize this almost exactly the way you do. And they say this is an inappropriate relationship with the deity. Now, as far as manipulating, let's say, for example, you're raising a child. I mean, from what I know of healthy parenting, it's good for the child to set boundaries, loving, you know, with love, not in a cold way, but to set boundaries. And it's good for the child to know that there are appropriate ways to behave, and that if you behave in appropriate ways, you'll have a better life. So if you teach your child, for example, not to abuse other people, not to abuse herself or himself, stay out of jail, you know, like the basics, I don't think you're teaching your child to exploit society, but rather how to, you know, to live in an appropriate, positive way so you can achieve your goals. So if I created a world, which I haven't, and I'm not aspiring to create one, and there are other religions for that where you aspire to become a creator god. But anyway, if I did create a world, and let's say the purpose of creating the world was to give fallen souls, to use that old term, a chance to rectify themselves, to get their acts together, to learn, to improve, and somehow restore themselves as spiritual beings, then I think it would be natural for me to sort of lay out the ground rules. And it's just like you, if you have a child, you want to teach your child. You want your child to understand how the world works and what you need to do to live well and to be healthy and so on. And so in that sense, a deity saying that this is what you need to do for your own edification, to have a healthy... I'll give an example of this, and really getting to the type of issue which can be easily construed or even abused in an exploitative relationship. In the Bhagavad Gita, Krishna talks about what he calls pravartitam chakram, which in Sanskrit means a wheel that has been made to turn, or a cycle. And the cycle he's talking about, which is basically the typical sacrificial agrarian cycle, is that you perform certain sacrifices, which you find throughout the ancient world. And if those sacrifices are performed appropriately, sincerely, then it brings rain. And food will grow, and you'll prosper. And then you take those fruits, you know, the harvest, and you make new offerings. And so this is what Krishna calls this a chakra, which in this sense means a cycle or a wheel, which has been made to turn. And then he says, one who does not keep the wheel turning, one who does not keep the wheel turning is living a sinful life. And so if we look at this structurally, we could say that teaching people to receive and give back, like to offer back. When you receive something, it's appropriate to offer back. And that this creates a cycle of giving and receiving.
But are you offering or are you paying? Because what you're describing is payment for rain.
I would say that paying is better than shoplifting. In other words, I would definitely want to teach my child that it's better to pay for what you take from other people than to steal it from them. And paying for what you take is not the last word in moral development or spiritual enlightenment. But I think it's a good principle that if you are receiving from others and you are taught, you have to give back. You have to reciprocate. Teaching people the principle of reciprocity, I think, is not something we should be cynical about. Again, in the Gita, it's not the last word. It's not the last stage of enlightenment. It's not the last, you know, stage of moral development, but it's something that you need to know.
agree with you, but I don't understand.
Okay,
come on. Yeah. But anyway, thank you for bringing that topic up.
I'm sorry, I thought this was connected to what you were talking about, and if I've taken you off track.
No, I appreciate all the questions. It was a good point. I'm sorry, this lady wanted... Because I got everybody aroused.
Can we bring bhakti into this at all?
Sure.
Because the experience of that you have with a deity is not one of payment, but of demonstrating your love. And the same thing back from the deity. So it's a whole different framework.
Whew, the U.S. Cavalry just rode in. Yeah, so... yes, that's... And that's an excellent point because and it ties into what I'm sorry I don't know your name but
Tim.
Yeah, it ties into what you said because ultimately, the whole bhakti movement, which has been and still is so important in that whole culture, teaches us that ultimately it's not just paying for services received, but ultimately, one stage is where you don't steal. Like even in the yoga system, the very first stage, yama niyama, the Ashtanga yoga system, you have to learn not to steal. I mean, one of the first things is you learn not to take things that don't belong to you, not to exploit other people. So as a way of stopping exploitation, yes, you receive and you give back. But ultimately, we have to come to the point of pure love. And at the stage of pure love, we just give out of pure love. Now, what's interesting is that in the bhakti tradition, often the deity, the visible deity, is the focus of that love. So that in a, let's say, a Vaishnava temple, Vaishnava means based on Vishnu or Krishna and so on, Rama. In a Vaishnava temple, those who are serious bhaktas, who are seriously devoted, I mean, obviously, some people go into the temple and say, like, you know, as they say, chuck in a buck for luck. You know, I'm going to give something to the deity, and here's my wish list. But all of the bhakti literature, the Bhagavad Gita, the Bhagavatam, all the most important bhakti literature says, no, you have to come to the point of pure love, where you don't demand anything, you don't expect. In fact, there's, I'll just quote you one little verse. It's sort of Sanskritic Bengali. Which it's about this. There's a statement that bhukti mukti siddhi kami sakali ashanta. That those who, you know this? No. That those who seek through their religious activities, bhukti, which means material enjoyment, like praying to God, you know, please give me that Ferrari or please give me this or that. Sunday morning television. So bhukti means just material enjoyment, or mukti, wanting salvation. Like I pray to God to save my neck, I want to be saved, which is also considered to be a selfish desire. And then siddhi. Siddhi means the yoga powers, trying to get the, you know, mystic powers. And so the statement is bhukti mukti siddhi kami sakali ashanta. All these people, those who are pursuing material enjoyment, even salvation, personal salvation, or mystic power, all of them are ashanta, not peaceful, because they still have selfish desires. But Krishna bhakta nishkam, one who's devoted to Krishna, or to God, the personal God, nishkam, has no nish is just another form of nir, like nirvana. Nishkam has no selfish desire. Ataiva shanta, therefore that person's actually peaceful. So the whole bhakti movement is to bring one to the point of giving up all material desires and worshiping God only out of love. But again, it's a very personal God that has name and form and all these things that the other school believes that we should transcend.
I'll talk to you after.
Okay. Yes.
Yeah. I'll just say this briefly thing. But I mean, this originally whole thing started with saying that this paradigm about. I think it was a iconoclastic view of a personal God is taken to the furthest extent to be destroying the environment.
Yeah, obviously Joseph Campbell did not want to destroy the environment. I mean, obviously. Yes.
When you defend it in appropriately so, and saying that it's not the goal of these people who believe in a personal goal.
It was the goal of some of them. It was the goal of some of them.
Hold on. It's not the goal, but it is actually a measurable result that is happening from the consciousness.
I'll just put that out there.
Okay. By the way, it was the goal of some. I mean, you have the concept in certain forms of Christian monasticism of mortifying the flesh. You don't merely, let's say, control yourself. So you just don't eat too much or don't, you're not promiscuous, but you actually mortify the flesh. I mean, I agree with what you said.
Well, I mean, there's also a certain lack of awareness, too.
I mean, the point is that good, intelligent people like Joseph Campbell are not going to trash the environment. However, this notion that the material world is profane did lead, in fact, historically, and this is very well known. I mean, this is not a controversial point of academic history, that this negative view toward nature led to all kinds of natural disasters. For example, we now know, in fact, Joseph Campbell makes a very interesting point. He says that what we call mythology is actually proto-science, in the sense that he says it's sort of the conflict between religion and science, the conflict between the older science of the ancient world and the newer science. Now, in fact, in the ancient world, religion and science were one. Religion, science, and philosophy were one. It was just all knowledge. And in fact, the Vatican, the same Vatican that persecuted Galileo, up to a certain point in history, was practically the main patron of the scientific revolution. The church loved science. What happened is that with the Renaissance, I mean, just very quickly, the Renaissance was actually a rebirth of what? Of Southern European culture, Athens and Rome. And there was a North European reaction against this. And you have people like Luther, for example. Martin Luther, was one of his slogans was sola fide, only faith. What did he mean, only faith, or sola scriptura, only scripture? He meant no science, no philosophy. He didn't even like... So the Protestant Reformation was sort of like a Palestinian purist backlash against the Renaissance. It wasn't just about church corruption. They actually started to fix that. It was really went much deeper than that. It was about rolling back the Renaissance, which they saw as a rebirth of pagan culture. And therefore, the divorce between religion and science in the Western world, as I put it, the papers were filed by religion, not by science. Luther rejected science. He didn't want philosophy. He just wanted the Bible as he interpreted it, and as no one else interpreted it. So again, he did very much have this view. Who gives a flying, you know what? About the material world. We don't want science because screw the material world. You know, we don't like the material world. So there really was an animosity toward nature. And it was reflected in monastic practices of mortifying the flesh and so on. And it did lead to ideas, for example, with the Industrial Revolution. I mean, Max Weber makes this point. That was the thing that kind of launched Western sociology. The whole point of the Protestant ethic. The Protestant ethic that the world is just there to be exploited, and the better you exploit it, the better Christian you are. And so... Yes?
My understanding is quite simple about it, and I'm hoping you can confirm that there's basically an immanent God and a transcendent God.
Mm-hmm.
And when there's an immanent God, everything is sacred. There's no profanity. And nature is sacred and holy. People are sacred and holy. Their piss and shit is sacred and holy.
The what?
Their piss and shit is sacred and holy. Immanence. The divine is within everything. Yeah. And then there's the transcendent God, where God is out there, somewhere else. That's the Judeo-Christian, Abrahamic God, and probably there are, in the Hindu Vedic tradition, you tend to go there. From that... Doesn't that arise from the transcendent God, which seems to be the Western spiritual orientation?
Okay,
then you can rape the world and women and everything else.
Yeah, what do they say? Rape the land and pillage the women. But yeah, it's a very good point. Now I want to respond to what you said. That's an excellent point. You brought up some very key terms and concepts here. In the Vedic Vaishnav tradition, it's both. So that, for example, the word Vishnu, by the way, there's a whole complex of names of a one God, monotheistic God. I mean, Krishna, Rama, Vishnu refers to the same person. And the oldest of these names in terms of the different, literary stratigraphy, I mean, the oldest layer of literature is Vishnu. Vishnu is the oldest name in the Rig Veda, which Joseph Campbell also quotes, and therefore the devotees are called Vaishnavas from the word Vishnu. The word Vishnu is etymologized from the Sanskrit root Vish, from this root, you can see this here, that thing means, like, it's pronounced like Vish, which means to enter, to penetrate. And so the very word Vishnu is... many scholars think originally meant that God who pervades the world, which is your immanence. At the same time that you have this, and that is the, in fact, you have statements in Sanskrit like Andantarasta Paramanu Chayantarasta, that the Lord is within every universe, because there are innumerable universes, within every atom. Paramanu Chayantarasta, within each atom, God is present. That's very immanent. And in the heart of every creature, every living creature. And yet at the same time, one of the most famous verses of the Rig Veda, like one of the anthems of the Rig Veda, is Tad Vishno Paramang Padang Sada Pashanti Suraya. That the godly people are always looking toward that supreme abode of Vishnu. So you have a Vishnu who totally pervades the universe, all the universes, who's everywhere, in every heart, and yet has a supreme abode, which is transcendent. So, I mean, you're right, that if we see God as only transcendent, there's this gap, this terrible gap between ourselves and God, we always fall short, and so on and so forth, then the world is sort of left to its own profane devices. But from the earliest literature, I think there was both.
Yeah, there is both.
Yes. Yes.
Isn't that what you were saying earlier about language? That language, there's kind of one camp of language that reality or God is outside of language, and yet the other is that what I hear is like language is sort of like a prism or crystal, and that God shines through language, and therefore is everywhere in everything.
Okay, yeah, let's talk about that. Yeah, okay, let me address your
okay,
what you said.
Trying to relate them.
Yeah, that's good. That's good. These are all very, very good points. I mean, so I thank you for raising these points. If you have something, whether it's language or anything, your personal beauty, if you have anything which you feel is limited, there are two ways you can go. And this great divide, it's like if you on both sides of the Vedanta divide, which is not just Vedanta, it's really world theology, in which Joseph Campbell comes down very strongly and insistently on one side of it. Both sides agree that the phenomenal world, I don't mean like fantastic, phenomenal, but I mean in the philosophical sense, phenomenon as something which presents itself directly to our senses, to our consciousness, as opposed to something beyond that we just can only reason about. So, in other words, literally the metaphysical, meta in Greek means beyond or after, so the metaphysical, what's beyond the physical. So, everyone agrees that the superficial, from the Latin word, the surface, superficie, the surface of the world, the surface of consciousness, the way the world just presents itself superficially to us, is not the last word. And it's limited, the world's limited. So then the question becomes, how do you break the limits? Now, this no name, no form, no concept is a process by Gunas. It's a process which is very well known in philosophy and theology and is called, in Latin, the via negativa, the negative way. And the idea is that you negate It's not this, it's not that, it's not the other thing, it's not this. And then when you've taken everything off, whatever is left, whatever that is, that's the truth. I mean, you find this technique very clearly in Buddha's second sermon. This is like sermon number two in the whole history of Buddhism. This is like still the grand opening. And sermon number two of the Buddha, the historical Buddha, Siddhartha Gautama, is known officially, has always been known, as the Sermon on the Non-Existence of the Self. That's what launched this whole anatma, no self program. What's interesting, because when I give courses on the history of religion in India, I always read the second sermon because it's only two paragraphs. And what's really, no wonder it became so popular, short sermons. But what's really fascinating about the second sermon of the Buddha on the non-existence of the self is that he never says the self doesn't exist. He never said that. And actually, if you study the history of Buddhism, like Buddhist philosophers say, well, why didn't he say it? Well, they try to come up with the reasons why he never said it, because he never said it. Yeah. All he said was, is, let's say, the bodily covering, like, you know, the different layers of covering, is the body covering the eternal self? Well, no, of course not. Are the mental coverings the eternal self? No. And he goes through his little checklist, which you also find in the Upanishads, by the way. I mean, there's the Buddhist version of this, and the second, but there's the Upanishads, they've got the same little checklist. So, and at the end of it, okay, this isn't the eternal self, that's not the eternal self, that's all, folks. And so, which in Sanskrit is tat sarvam janaha, that means in Sanskrit, that's all, folks. But this is, so that's a via negativa, which you see like in nirvana. What's the goal? Get rid of vana. And then what are you left with? They're still talking about it 2,500 years later. So, alimony. So, in the same way, by the way, I mean the personalist literatures, because, I mean, and using the word impersonal, I don't think that I'm misrepresenting Joseph Campbell, because he says, yeah, he says that, here's a quote from him. There's a transcendent energy source. That's Vedanta. The Vedanta begins by saying, Janmadhyasya Jataha, the Absolute is the source of everything. So he uses that language. There's a transcendent energy source. Mythic worship addresses that. But he says, that old man up there has been blown away. Well, I suppose is kind of like Jehovah. By the way, the word Jehovah is a mispronunciation of German. Anyway, that's actually not even the Hebrew word, but never mind that. So the old man up there has been blown away. You've got to find the force inside you. And then, from the ultimate energy, it's the life of the universe. And then do you say, well, there must be somebody generating that energy. In other words, if there's a source of me, somebody must be generating that. And then he says, why say that? Why can't the ultimate mystery be impersonal? So, again, I just read that to show that I don't think I'm falsely attributing that view to him. So, the personalist literatures, by the way, agree with Joseph Campbell that we have to get beyond, these are the Sanskrit words, nama rupa. Nama means name, which Campbell talks about, you have to go beyond names, like the name God. And rupa means form, like which he calls sort of like ethnic forms. He thinks they're all created ethnically. And so the personalist literature also says you've got to go beyond this. However, there is a spiritual. Krishna, for example, the word rupa is form. In the Bhagavad Gita, Krishna speaks about what he calls his own achintya rupa, inconceivable form. And as far as saying God is not knowable, I mean, in a sense, I agree with Joseph Campbell, but I want to distinguish between two words, because they're different and they can be confused and lead to misconceptions of what it means not to be knowable. One word is achintya, and okay, this is the privative particle in grammar, not, like atheist, agnostic. So a means not. And here's the verbal root, chint, and ya means able, So not chintable. That's what it means. Now, what does chint mean? Well, not exactly. I mean, it's chint. I'm going to contrast it with the word knowable, because chint in Sanskrit means, sort of, I guess, what we would call in Western philosophy unaided human reason. The verb chint can mean to worry about something, like you chint over something. So, in other words, if you just sort of sit down and try to figure everything out yourself and intellectually worry about things, that's kind of chint. And therefore, in the Gita also, you find the statement that God is not chintable. I mean, you can't... What? Yeah.
Figure outable.
But there's another word. The Sanskrit word jnana, of course, Greek gnosis, which means knowledge. And so then you can have the word gyatavyam, which means knowable. So the position of the personal school, like Bhagavad Gita, is that God is knowable, but not figure outable by yourself. There are things that we can't figure out ourselves. For example, there's a whole history of physics, let's say. If you look at the scientific revolution, going back to whenever they really got serious about this stuff for centuries, if someone is born today and just ignores the entire history of science, says, I'll just sit under the old oak tree and figure out everything, up to and including the latest physics.
There is no global warming.
Yes. Yeah, that's...
Ignoring all science.
Yeah, exactly. What are the modern obscurantists? So, but it's knowable. I mean, there are things that you cannot figure out yourself, but you can know them if you hear from the right source. And so there's these two words. Well, the word in Sanskrit, achintya, you could say words like gyatavya, knowable. I mean, there's different ways to make. So gyatavya means knowable. So the idea was you can know God, but you can't figure it out yourself, because for the simple reason, you can't figure out something which is infinitely greater than yourself. See, someone who hasn't answered. Yeah, maybe someone who hasn't asked yet. Yes.
Okay, it seems that there's kind of a thing that's going along with something within the physics realm that's being looked at, which is kind of, is it a wave or a particle? You know, it's that objectified, you know, God looking like the old man up in heaven, you know, or the image before us, the iconoclastic kind of version, versus the energy that is infinite, that has no name, but perhaps could be really energy and matter, and kind of the two. And I find it interesting that in religion, it seems that often it's like one school or the other, instead of that there's actually something that's, you know, really biomimicry, you know, in its functional relationship between, you know, the essence of life in its form and the spirit that it's imbued with. And so I'm just curious how you would...
Right, good question. Very good question. The personal school would say that the, let's say, sort of the anthropomorphic God, the old, you know, sort of the gerontal God. By the way, gerontology and everything, just another little Indo-European treat at no extra cost to yourself. In Sanskrit, gera means old age. And so you see geron, geriatrics and all that. But anyway, so the geriatric God. The God on life support. So, philosophical life support, I guess, at this point. So, the idea is consider, for example, I'll start with Plato and then go to Vedanta. Yeah. I like Plato. He's one of the good guys. Plato, in his Republic, revolts against Homer. Which is a very heavy thing to do, because the Greeks had what they called their paideia, their educational system. It's like in the Roman world, Greek education was like, you know, they basically wrote the curriculum for the Roman world. And so, but in traditional, at the time of Plato, traditional Greek education was based on Homer. That was their book. And Plato makes the extremely radical, shocking, revolutionary statement that we should not teach Homer to our children. And the reason we shouldn't teach Homer to our children is because he teaches us about these adolescent gods that, you know, basically need to be medicated. And so, and who are really amoral, like there's a battle going on down on Earth and, you know, Zeus will say, I like Ajax, not the foaming cleanser. I mean, you know, Ajax, the fighter. And Hera may say, why do you like Ajax? Why do you like Ajax? I don't know. I think he's cool. I think I'm going to kill his enemies. It's like, there's no justice. There's no morality. It's just, yeah, he's cool. I like him. I just like him. It's all whimsical. And so, the term straw man argument was brought up. And so I'd like to use it, that same term in this case. If you know Houston Smith, you know, world religions and all that, there are different, and even actually, Joseph Campbell talks about this also in his little chart of the evolution of mythology from hunting-gathering societies to early agrarian and mature agrarian high civilization, so on. So, if you look at polytheism, and this, I think, is a crucial distinction, which I'm not sure if Joseph Campbell made it. I can't say he didn't, but I didn't come across it. And often in arguments on behalf of the impersonal energy, they don't make this crucial distinction. And that is, and we'll get back to Plato's Republic. If you look at polytheisms all over the world, they tend to be, practically invariably, pre-philosophical. In other words, for example, if you're a physicist, you want to find the one grand equation. You want to find, you know, the Occam's razor, the one expression, the one equation which explains everything or as much as possible. And so if you say there are many gods, it doesn't really explain anything. And so Plato, as a philosopher, rejected the sort of adolescent polytheism of Greece, which was typical of polytheisms, and he wanted a philosophical monotheism. And yet he didn't at all reject a personal god. If you look at Plato's Socrates and the Phaedrus and so on, I mean, Socrates, which is Plato speaking through Socrates, giving the argument that just as there's a consciousness within the body, so the universe is a body, there's a personal consciousness within the universe. And so Plato, absolutely, if you look at his last book, I mean, you know, his last work, The Law, he doesn't reject the idea of a personal deity at all, but he wants a philosophical, reasonable monotheism, not an irrational polytheism. And so often when you look at the arguments against a personal god, what we're hearing is arguments against the irrational polytheism or a type of god who, if he existed, would be the most evil monster ever conceived. I mean, a serial torture, torturing your own children forever. I mean, torturing your own children for 5 minutes is pretty shocking, but torturing your own children forever for mental crimes. Mental crimes. Like, you didn't believe the right doctrine. It's more than wrong. It's practically evil. I mean, that idea, in my view, that idea. Because it portrays God as evil. John Stuart Mill said, how can I worship a God who's morally inferior to a good human being? So just to wrap up that little topic, if you look not at the polytheisms, and not at the sort of the pre-philosophical polytheisms or the tribal monotheisms. If you look at the sociology of the Middle East, we can talk about the desert, we can talk about different conditions. It tended to be an extremely tribal area with all that sociology of tribalism, which they put right on religion. So my God can beat up your God. And it's something extremely tribal and violent. So if you look at tribal monotheisms, or if you look at pre-philosophical polytheisms and argue against those, you're ignoring the very sophisticated philosophical monotheisms, like the kind that Plato puts forward, like the kind that's put forward in Bhagavad Gita. These are intellectually extremely sophisticated, and they are ethical, and they answer. So, and what I tend to see is that the arguments of the impersonal energy group, they don't really address the philosophical monotheisms. They address either the pre-philosophical polytheisms or the tribal monotheisms. And also, I should say, non-philosophical tribal monotheisms. Yes?
Is that because people would rather subscribe to a religion that encourages them to kill other people rather than an intellectual religion that doesn't allow them to get out that aggression?
Poor humanity. People in general... As you know, people in general... Actually, Joseph Campbell has a very nice quote, if I could find it very on this very point. If I can find it. Yeah. But anyway, he says something like that... if only I could find that. Something like, he doesn't reject myth. He rejects taking myths, as he calls them, as literally true, like there really is a God of rain. He says, well, no, that's not true. But then again, he rejects what he sees as the other extreme of saying that myth is useless. He says, no, it's good, because he said, this is the language of the soul, he says, which is also a myth, a metaphor. And he says that that these myths, many of them, have actually restrained people and at least given ethical systems. And you can argue, I mean, you definitely argue that all the ethical and moral systems, flawed as they were, that actually to any extent restrained human passions and greed and violence, all emanated from metaphysical systems. If you want to look at a whole civilization which was secular and just kind of worked out rational social contracts and behaved very nicely toward each other, you're going to look high and low. You can find positions like that, but positions like that that really sustain civilizations, very difficult. Yes. So he does give that credit.
How come as the mammal gets a larger and larger brain,
I didn't answer your question.
More,
yes.
Cruel. The chimpanzees, the dolphins, the human beings, they become more and more cruel. Why?
But also they can become more virtuous. I mean, I think they become intel. There's a Sanskrit saying. Budhir jasya balang tasya. One who has buddhi, which means intelligence. Balang tasya. That person has power. So intelligence is power. So when you have power, it can be used for good or evil. So you can talk about the most magnificent acts of virtue done by certain humans and the most horrible acts of cruelty. So I think, you know, it's that power which can go... But just, I didn't really answer your question, like why people prefer something. People tend to look for a religion which kind of allows, which fits their own state of mind. I mean, the number of people that, let's say, choose a religion because they honestly, sincerely from the heart, want to transform themselves, they want to purify their soul, they want to become pure souls, I mean, that's not why most people...
And Campbell's Four Functions of a Viable Mythology speaks to that.
I have that here.
Yeah.
The metaphysical function, awakening a sense of awe about the mystery of being. But then he says, the mythic symbols that point beyond themselves. So Campbell's Four Functions of Myth, none of them are, of course, because of his view, to actually get in touch with, Sanskrit word for get in touch with, yoga. To actually get in touch with a personal deity. That's not one of the reasons that myths exist, because there are no such things. And so I'd like to, if I could, just read the definition of metaphor, because it's very interesting, because it's one of Campbell's favorite words. He uses the word metaphor a lot. And I've got everything somewhere here. Oh my God, where's metaphor? I have it. Here it is. So a metaphor is a figure of speech in which a word or phrase is applied to an object or action to which it is not literally applicable. Not literally. For example, I had fallen through a trap door of depression, said Mark, who is fond of theatrical metaphors. So his depression was not literally a trap door. So that's a metaphor. So if you look at the functions of metaphor, as you mentioned, which, just very briefly, the metaphysical function, to serve as a metaphor for a higher truth which has no name or form, a cosmological function, proto-science, sociological function, early societies had to, I mean, not only early societies, every society has to stick together. In America, if for example, this political dysfunction and these kind of like What are you, the economy so bad now that Exxon had to lay off 25 congressmen? I'm sorry, did you want to say more about that? About the four functions?
And the last one is the psychological.
Yes, please.
The psychological function is helping the individual through the different stages of life. And if you find a lot of, I think, church membership, etc., if you ask a lot of people, it's the psychological and emotional component that keeps, you know, people attached many times to their religion, that it's the emotional, psychological benefits that they derive from it.
Good point. Yeah, I agree with you.
And from a Maslowian perspective, hierarchy basically gives people an identity and a sense of belonging, power in numbers.
Right. Yes, ma'am.
I'm going to ask you a question about what you think, or what anybody thinks, about the change in our society. It seems to me there's been a change in our society. When I went to school a million years ago, there was a basic question, do you believe in God? And your answer was either yes or no. And if it was no, you were an atheist, and if it was yes, that was pejorative. You know, there was something wrong with you there. And if you were a good person, you believed in God. And what were we thinking? I mean, it seems to me we're not thinking that way anymore, that we're understanding that kind of narrow definition of the God thing isn't the way we are thinking anymore. We are thinking more when we think about the word God as a more abstract or I like the way that, is it the theosophist, the one about whom naught can be said?
Except that not can be said about him.
I took some study thing that had that definition of God, which I was rather liked. But don't you think something's changed in the basic culture?
Well, the globalization of sort of metaphysics, in the sense that we, you know, now it's, I think it's a much larger conversation. It's not just a particular dogma or doctrine, and so people are thinking.
But haven't we sort of evolved, you think, in the last whatever?
The dialectic is moving forward, but I think that we should not throw out baby God with the bathwater, in the sense of, I think that to assume that the infinite is on the energy side and to say God is personal limits God. As soon as I finish, then you can have the next question. I just wanted to... So, for example, there was a group of Orphics back in ancient Greek times, called the Orphics. They had a very interesting notion of form. They had the notion that form actually destroys limits rather than limiting. I'll give you a few examples of that. Let's say take sound or noise. If you take sound and say how much meaning, like if you just hear a sound like how much, but if you take that same sound and shape it, I mean, morphologically, into language. And language is extremely sophisticated. Even you may just have a little chat with someone, but if you break it all down, it's just ordinary language is extremely sophisticated and structured, which is why computers still can't have normal conversations in the full sense of the word. So when you shape sound into language, you increase meaning. And the better you know language, the more you can express, and the more words you know, the more subtleties, semantic subtleties and nuances, and then you put language, let's say, in the hands of a Shakespeare or someone like that, like in that Sense and Sensibility, the one Emma Thompson did, that movie. Mm-hmm. And by the way, I'm a big Jane Austen fan. Anyway, so you know that great sonnet from Shakespeare, which she used, "Love is not love that alters when it alteration finds, that bends with the remover to remove. No, it is a fixed mark that is looks upon tempests or storms and is not shaken." So, I mean, words, if love can be infinite, is there really a limit to language? So again, just to make one, and then I'm going to ask, have you speak. I don't want you to be frustrated, but just one point to wrap this topic that That if you, and this is what I wanted to make, and I kind of got, we went other directions, but if you find there are limitations, like the nama rupa, the name and the form, there's limitations in something, whether it's God or whatever, there's two ways you can go. Either you kind of reject that, or you extend it to infinity. Why not, if you think of infinite form, like you can shape sound into language, you can, a great artist can shape color and form and geometry into the most brilliant works of art. Marlene's a really good painter. So the idea is that form can be used to expand meaning and feeling to infinity. And so the personal view is that you extend to achieve the infinite, you extend, you don't negate. I'm sorry, this lady is patiently even.
Yeah, I think really the ultimate question is, does God even really care if we believe in him, her, or it? I think that what's important, are we kind?
Okay, I will give an argument. I'm argumentative.
I'm a radical vegan, by the way.
What?
I'm a radical vegan.
Oh, good for you.
I'm pleased.
If, for example, when I was a little child, on my father's birthday, my mother would give me a little money and take me to buy a gift for my father. And on my mother's birthday, my father would do the same. Now, obviously, they didn't need the gift. You know, every year it was like either a cologne or a tie for my father and little bath bubbles for my mother. So it was like the same thing every year when I was a child. But they were teaching me, and I'm extremely grateful they taught me to be grateful and to express my love. And so is God attached, like, you know, God has self-esteem issues or... No, absolutely not. He's not jealous, he's not any... Or he or she...
The Old Testament is.
Yeah, but jealousy is not a virtue.
Vengeful God.
But the point is, God teaching us to be grateful and to love and to reciprocate. The fact that our parents taught us to be grateful and to reciprocate and taught us to express love, that was a gift they gave us.
What does that have to do with God?
Why?
Yeah.
Because if God is the source of our existence, if Vedanta is right, and if, I mean, even Joseph Campbell talks about an energy which is the source. So whether it's personal or impersonal, everyone agrees it's the source. So if a personal consciousness is the source of our existence, to love us. If you love someone, you want them to flourish. You want them to be happy. You want them to be successful in every way. That's what it means to love someone. And so a loving God would naturally desire that we flourish. And perhaps the most essential characteristic to flourish is to learn to love. Just like you love the animals, so that's a great thing. So learning to love and to be grateful and to reciprocate and all that stuff, that is perhaps the core, of the essence of flourishing as a conscious being. So that's why a parent, a loving parent that says, okay, my kids, you know, even though, let's say it's a good parent, a good mother, a good father, and the child is ungrateful and curses a good loving parent, If the parent says, "Well, I don't care," you can curse. I mean, then you're not caring about your child. To care about the child for the child's sake is to teach them gratitude and love, especially where there's a worthy object of that gratitude and love.
So, what are you saying? You have to be unkind sometimes.
Not unkind. It's kindness. When the parents who out of love, not out of some weird psychology, but parents who out of love discipline their children and teach them certain things, how to express their own love. I mean, the parents are acting out of love in the ideal case.
Yeah, I was thinking about what Suzanne was asking for, quandary. And we touched upon the fact that the dogma of religion essentially contains our animalistic, survivalist nature, which can be very violent. And in my writing, I write that within Mother Nature, there actually is no morality. There is no good, there is no bad, there is no right, there is no wrong. it's really all about, is this behavior going to enhance survival, or is it going to diminish survival? Is it going to pass on the DNA? Is this group going to survive or not? And what's happening in the dogma of religion gives certain people that need an identity, it bonds them together, it also simultaneously separates them from others. So the ones that are more fear-driven loss of identity, they're going to bond strongly and they're going to fight everyone else and try to dominate that territory of the world. But the other side of the coin is that there's a huge population of the planet that's falling away from dogmatic religion. Now everything's kind of spiritual. It's kind of about me and my evolution and stuff. So there's a lack of that discipline or the confining concepts of dogma going on, which allows really rampant behavior on the other side of it. So the dogma allows us to victimize others, but to basically live a moral life within our own belief system, and the spiritualization or the falling away from dogma is allowing us to essentially let ego do what it wants to do in order to...
That's a very good point, but there is, I think, a happy medium, a golden mean.
In terms of extremes.
No, okay. First of all, I'd say that, I mean, that's a very good picture you've drawn. I would say, make a few points. Number one, I would argue that there is morality in nature. In the sense of, but you might find an animal type of proto-morality. We do find cases, I mean, you can see it, you know, YouTube's got all this stuff, where one animal will actually stay with another animal, even of a different species, and protect it and take care of it.
Yeah, but and, it has nothing to do with morality.
No, you see, but again, you're begging the question, and I'll explain how.
Okay.
Because the two options here are bottom-up or top-down. In other words, do we kind of like evolve up from the, you know, the cosmic slime or muck or something, and that everything is just, you know, this kind of like the evolution myth, where everything is just, you know, survival instinct, or does everything come from the divine? If everything comes from the divine, then and human beings, for example, you're a vegan. And to me, that is a, in a very admirable sense, a moral position.
My cats are not.
What's that?
Because I believe in ahimsa and they.
Yeah, you're okay. But there's a good example. So the fact that I said, what was your name?
Suzanne. Or Butterfly.
Suzanne Butterfly. The fact that you have this strong moral concern for other creatures, that is natural. That is her nature. In other words, the idea that human beings are outside of nature is itself an unnatural idea. Yes, and therefore, but human beings naturally, when they are developed, have very strong moral concerns. And we see civilizations, like, again, going back to Megasthenes and his description of India almost 2,500 years ago, it's a place where there was discipline, there was morality, and yet there was tolerance and openness and freedom. And I think the problem is that we are extremely Western-centric. And we tend to see, when we say religion, what we really mean is the religions we have experience of. And we talk very much about this part of the world. But actually, there are civilizations which have transcended that dichotomy you talked about, which managed to have the discipline and morality. And I would say when animals take care of each other, I don't think that's just an instinct that evolved for survival. I think it's the original pure consciousness of that creature. Because inside the body of the dolphin or the cat or the penguin or the cockroach or whatever, inside those bodies from the Upanishad point of view, Vedanta point of view, is a pure soul capable of unlimited consciousness. But it's like, let's say you take an electric light. If you take an electric light and cover it so the light doesn't come through, or then let's say it's opaque, you put one layer of covering, then two layers of covering, the light gets dimmer and dimmer, but inside is the same light. And so I would say that animals, in many cases, have lost touch with a lot of the morality which they have as pure souls. And when they do show certain features, we can say it's survival, or it may just be their original nature kind of like shining through a little bit.
Do you feel that way about bacteria?
about bacteria. That's very interesting. Yeah, I mean, I would take the position.
You're bacteria.
I would take the position that matter never lives. There's no such thing as living matter. It's the soul that lives. And so wherever you see life, there is a soul in some kind of material form. So matter itself, and I hope I don't offend anyone, but dead matter. Matter doesn't live, it's just matter.
Matter doesn't exist in a lot of beliefs. It's illusionary.
It's what?
It's an illusion by matter itself.
Well, even in the most radical Buddhist systems, they didn't really say it didn't exist. What they denied was, if you look at Nagarjuna, for example, the famous Buddhist philosopher and logician, it's sometimes misunderstood their Shunyavad, their emptiness doctrine. They didn't say it doesn't exist. What they said was, it's always in flux, and therefore what doesn't really exist is a fixed object.
Right.
Because of mutual dependence and constant flux and so on. But actually, the Buddha said that they claim to have the Madhyamaka, the middle path, precisely because, at least, there's so many schools of Buddhism. Buddhism is extremely variegated, but those who adopted the sort of Nagarjuna line of Shunyavad said that they had the middle path because one extreme was to say there's an eternal soul, which, although many Buddhists, by the way, did accept that, but these Buddhists didn't accept it. And the other extreme was to say that it doesn't really exist. So to say that matter doesn't even really exist is one of the extremes the Buddhists claim they were avoiding by taking the middle path.
What's the main reason?
Back there, that lady, maybe I could, I'm sorry, and then...
Yes. The first time in India, I experienced all kinds of different spiritual, places, and that's mostly what my friend Vian and I were looking for. But at one extreme was the most aggressive factory, hoarding us through like cattle experience, where we almost feared for our life, where these people talk about barter with God in many other temples as well, where it was just all pushing us aside to get their flowers and get their,
prayers
and then bam, out. And it was just really disconcerting because I expected to find like the Mother Earth, the umbilicus of spirituality.
That's also that India has got everything.
Well, that was the
Kali. Yeah, I know what you mean. I also have the same reaction to those places.
Well, I mean, everybody's getting what they're getting out of their religion. No matter, where they're at in life, or if you believe in past lives, where they're in this life. So if somebody believes in a war god, like you were, this gentleman here in the front was talking about, a god that would allow them to go to war, then maybe they have to kill somebody. Maybe that's part of what they're here to experience. Another justification, maybe that's part of their destiny.
But again, for example, let's give an example. Let's say, and this is the kind of example you get in philosophy classes. Let's say we're all sitting here, and obviously this is a room full of good people. And let's say someone bars through the door, and we knew, we had very, very good reason to assume that person was going to kill everybody here. And not for some higher cause, but just because it's a crazy evil person that's going to kill everybody in this room.
Okay.
Now, let's say one of us has the power to kill that person. And in philosophy, you can do this. You can set it up the way you want. And let's also say the circumstances are that you don't have the luxury of merely wounding him or stopping him because, let's say, you've only got one weapon and you've just got to go for it. And you don't really, you really have to stop the person, put the person down. So do you say, well, no, because, we shouldn't kill anyone, but knowing that that will directly result in a large number of innocent people dying, or do you stop the person?
Well, wait a second. That's, you make your own personal choice. But if your personal choice is not to kill that person, you better hope there's somebody who believes in killing them who's going to save you.
Yeah, that's why I'm because...
So that's my point, that we all have to respect, and just because we believe differently than other people, to think that our beliefs are better than them is a huge mistake.
I don't think so.
I think absolutely.
But you just did it. Because you think that people that think that their beliefs are relative are better than people that think their beliefs are the only way. And so you just did what you said we shouldn't do.
It's true.
So in other words, I think the problem is, here's what I think the problem is. You know what PTSD is? Post-traumatic stress disorder. Well, from what I've learned, two of the main symptoms of PTSD, hope I get this right, are hypervigilant and withdrawal. In other words, if you've had a traumatic experience, you're like hypervigilant because your nervous system is afraid it'll happen again. And, like a car backfires and you dive for cover because you were in combat or something. And so if you look at the religious history of the West, especially in Europe, but we had our moments also in America, without question, it's traumatic. It is a traumatic history. Walking out of your cottage one morning and seeing your neighbors burning alive at the stake is traumatic. So there is a type of collective, societal, civilizational PTSD going on. And therefore, because of this reaction against fanatical, exactly the thing that Joseph Campbell fought against, and I admire him for that, and I salute him for that. I think he did a very great thing by opposing that type of violent fanaticism. But because of that, if you look at, just to speak crudely, the New Age movement or whatever, and I'm just using a crude term because it's late and it's quicker. If you look at that, there's a type of PTSD. There's a hypervigilance against truth claims. Like if someone claims that this is... Now, if you look at the history of India, for the most part, people did disagree, but they didn't kill each other. And therefore, they could just argue about it because they knew there was mutual respect. They're not going to kill each other.
A few million gods, right?
Not the serious. Yeah, there are. I mean, there's probably more than that. But not in the philosophical monotheisms. There's actually very few candidates. So what I'm trying to say is that hypervigilance, like as soon as someone claims that what they're saying is right and what someone else is saying is wrong, it's like, oh my God, back to the Inquisitions. Back to the Middle Ages. No, it's not. It's just saying that I think this is right. For example, if someone says God has inspired me to go blow up a school bus to make a political statement, I have no hesitation in saying that's not really what God wants you to do. Oh, hi.
This is for you.
Oh, thank you.
That's you now.
Aloha.
Yeah, yeah.
So, thank you. Thank you very much. So I think there's a moderate, reasonable, tolerant, inclusive way of saying that I think this is right and that's wrong. Because otherwise we end up saying that something is right is wrong, and not saying something is right, and we're still saying something is right and wrong.
With that in mind...
Standing on the corner.
Are you
going to
speak?
No, I'm sorry, did you?
Okay. With that,
hey, Joyce.
But,
hi.
I'm just maybe one more question.
Sure, sure.
Okay.
Bedtime.
This will be the last question.
Yes. Oh, this girl back there. Oh, okay, you can definitely ask your question back there.
Well, you can go ahead first.
Okay.
I've
really appreciated this. This travelogue through the history and philosophy of religion, but I'm starting to realize, particularly when you're talking about that Orphic cult and they were talking about sound, the example then you chose was word, which is language, which is left brain, which tends to be
meant. Or music.
Well, so I was going to ask you, you could have chosen, or we could have gone down the path of a flute.
Sure.
Music. No
yes.
Philosophy, no language, no reason, no logos, but...
I would disagree because music is very much a language.
Okay, yeah. But it's not the language of the left brain, and it's not the language...
Yeah.
So this is my question.
Yeah.
Among all these philosophers that you talked about,
right?
Are there any women?
Yes. Gurgi, personally, I would not want to amputate either side of my brain. I'm very happy that I got two sides. And No. But what I'm saying is, I don't think we need to go. It's like left brain. In other words, if there has been a period in history, let's say, of chauvinism or overemphasis on this side of the brain, I don't want to go to the other extreme. I think that, as the French say, "Vive la différence." It's you know, we have God-given two sides of the brain. I think language is a wonderful thing. I mean, simple words like, some, you know, the right person at the right moment saying "I love you" can be infinite. And so I don't think language is a bad thing or anything like that. And I also personally, I'm very deeply into music. I play music. I compose music. And it's very much a language. And so, yeah, it's all good.
Women philosophers.
Yes.
Any that you could?
Gargi in the Upanishads. She was a guru to kings.
Was her
Janava
position?
Yeah, Janava.
Her understanding at all at odds with the traditional?
No. She was an Upanishadic sage.
I also recommend The Alphabet Versus the Goddess by Leonard Schlein. Mm-hmm. Interesting, yes, book.
This poor girl back there has been waiting so long. Yes. Did you?
Yeah, so I'd like for you to expand more upon your point about how some of these long-held beliefs have contributed to the destruction of the environment. That's something that I've been working in for 20 years, and more recently doing public speaking about overpopulation, human overpopulation, and the general unconsciousness, even in places like India, where the population is supposed to double by 2050.
Yikes.
So what I'd like to know is, because I think in general, the problems with polluting and destroying the environment and, you know, taking up so much a share of the planet and taking away care capacity from other species and all of that does have to do with the point you made, which is not realizing the unity of all things, that we really need to share with one web of life, etc.
So yes.
How can we take what you're saying and bring it to the world today to try to save the human species?
Well, you're doing a good job. I thought you were quite eloquent. Yeah. I mean, that's it. Well, we all have to. I think we should also go out and teach. Perhaps I can say one thing because you, based on your point, and that is, we did bring some books here based on ancient texts which give that personal philosophy, and it's one way you can learn about the other side of the great conversation, let's say, not fight between these different, the personal and impersonal way of looking at it. I think my own view, and again, this is, you know, like, here's my ingredients label, this is my own view, I think that it's very dangerous, maybe not for, you know, great mystics and yogis who are always going to be good people. But I think it's very dangerous to give the message out that somehow you as a person, as a caring person, are not real, that when you really become enlightened, you stop being personal. I think what we need is to learn how to be personal, how to be real persons, pure persons, loving persons, how to see that it's a personal universe, and to care for it and to love it and ourselves. And so I think the impersonal message is the last thing we need right now, personally. I think what we really need is to learn how to be a real person, which means loving, compassionate, kind, and that things like love and relationship and care and compassion, those are real, those are eternal, and those can be extended to infinity. We have to expand our personalism. We have to expand our kindness, our compassion, our personal consciousness, and see. Yeah, so I think the personalism is really, we need more personalism, not less.
What are you saying is the impersonal message in teaching environmentalism or sustainability?
Well, we're going over time. I'll wrap this up. I'm afraid Joyce is going to be unhappy with me. It's in Buddhism, for example. Because Buddhism was 100 different movements. If you look at the history of Buddhism, it was a whole complex of different movements. And some people said there's no soul. Other Buddhist schools, which are people you don't know about now, like the Pudgalavada, for example, who were very prominent in North India, they were a very important Buddhist school. They said, hey, wait a second. If there's no person, who gets the karma? I mean, why are we so concerned about good and bad karma? And they were extremely concerned about that. How can you, within the Buddhist movement, they made this argument, if we are ultimately not persons, if there's ultimately no right and wrong, then I can do, that can lead to nihilism. I can do anything, because after all, I'm not really a person anyway, and if I kill that person, well, that really wasn't a person anyway, and you may say it was wrong to kill that person, but you're being judgmental, and, you know, it's just like, where does it end? So I think we have to, you know, the Hegelian dialectic, Berkeley. Thesis, antithesis, synthesis. The thesis is dogmatic, fanatical, violent, sectarian religion. It's like, boo. And then the antithesis is, okay, no name, no form, no rules, no right and wrong, just go to the opposite extreme. The synthesis is what I call, in my own life, principled inclusivism. We are inclusive, but based on reasonable principles. And so we've got to move beyond this. We're stuck in the antithesis stage, where everyone is just like trying not to be a fanatical Christian. And so the point is not to not be a fanatical Christian. The point is to move forward to the synthesis, which, as this gentleman, actually, one of these people here said, I think you said that, to have morality, some things are right and wrong. It is wrong for me to harm an innocent person. That is wrong. And it's right for me. It's right what you're doing by your, you know, veganism and speaking and everything. That's right. It's not neutral. It's correct. It's right. It's good. And we have to sort of retake moral language, but in a reasonable, inclusive, spiritual way. So I better end before I get in trouble. Hey, thank you.